Track 13. Next, we bring you the Past Lives feature, looking at the people who made our county great. First is Elwin the Great Eccentric. Reputedly a descendant of Pocahontas, the Reverend Whitwell Elwin was an eccentric ecclesiastic and editor with architectural pretensions. Chris Armstrong investigates the life of the designer of Booton Church.
Those venturing into rural North Norfolk, if they take the Reefham turn off the Norwich Halt Road, will be rewarded with the sight of a remarkable church, St Michael and All Angels, at Booton. But if the church is remarkable, then the man who built it was more remarkable still. The church, the building of which occupied the last 24 years of Elwin's life and was funded from his personal wealth, is a remarkable hodgepodge of styles. He borrowed the design of different aspects from different churches. The windows and doors include copies of those in such diverse locations as Glastonbury Abbey, Lichfield Cathedral, and St. Stephen's Chapel, Westminster. The building is crowned with a minaret between two slender towers, and the interior is illuminated through a remarkable collection of stained glass portrayals of angels, the models for some of which were amongst what today might be called Elwin's groupies. Over the years, he became friendly with young ladies he described as his blessed girls, some of whom accompanied him while he toured the country, sketching aspects of other churches he could adopt for his new creation. These relationships do not seem to have been in any way inappropriate, just unusual. One of the blessed girls was Emily, a granddaughter of Bulwer Lytton, who many years later published her voluminous correspondence with Elwin, which began when she was 13 and Elwin was in his early 70s, and continued until her 20s when she married Sir Edwin Lytons, the architect perhaps best remembered for the design of the cenotaph. He reputedly described Booton Church as naughty but built in the right spirit. The building of the new church was an expensive project. Many Victorian clergy used their personal wealth to improve their churches, even if subsequent generations might have preferred some to have remained unimproved on the grounds of taste. But the undertaking by Elwin was in a class of its own. Yet, as we understand from a review in The Spectator in 1903, he was not, according to his son, a man who took holy orders from any sense of vocation, but rather to take advantage of the family living at Booton once it became vacant. The incumbent at the time, his cousin Caleb, kept him waiting 10 years. In the interim, Elwin came to be seen as a major literary figure. Certainly his interests were primarily literary and with the literati. As a young man, he was first published in the Quarterly Review and became something of a protégé of its then editor, J.G. Lockhart. When Lockhart retired in 1853, his recommendation of Elwin as his successor found favour with the publisher John Murray, even though Elwin had, by that time, succeeded his cousin Caleb to the Booton benefice. He was well connected for such a post, an intimate friend of Thackeray and Goldsmith, and an acquaintance of both Dickens and Scott. He was also on good terms with many other distinguished men of the day. Although he published no fewer than 42 of his own works in his 7 years as editor, he was able to secure contributions from such as Prime Ministers Gladstone and Cecil, the latter contributing almost as often as Elwin himself. Of course, it wasn't all due to his influence. The Quarterly Review was an extremely prestigious journal. Established in 1809 by the famous publisher John Murray, it was the brainchild of George Canning, the first Foreign Secretary and later Prime Minister, who died less than 4 months after taking that office. The editorship of such a journal was both a signal honour and a very demanding task. Elwin had become rector 3 years earlier, but for the next 7 years he had to spend much of his time in London, especially as publication date approached. Elwin was not, perhaps, the most typical of country clergy, but then he was not the most conventional of men. And the church had plenty of previous form when it came to absentee incumbents. He doesn't appear to have had much reservation about spending long periods away from his parochial duties. Though combining the roles of squire and rector as he did, He was dutiful about discharging his other obligations, even enlisting in the volunteers when a French invasion was feared. There is little evidence of his style of ministry, and what there is partly comprising anonymous notes in files at the county record office left, one infers, by his successors. These present an interesting, if incomplete, picture. He was, unsurprisingly, apparently inclined to preach extremely lengthy sermons delivered with his eyes shut and his head uplifted, in terms which were intellectually a great deal over the heads of his rural congregation. In an area where nonconformism and simplicity of worship were challenging the authority of the established church, this may not have endeared him to his parishioners. One essential tool for any rural clergyman in those days was the possession of a horse in order to visit the outlying parts of the parish. As Elwin, an animal lover, kept no horse, it seems reasonable to infer that visiting was not high on his list of priorities. Though one note refers to him as benign, another tells of his unwillingness to visit an elderly woman on her deathbed, because he believed her to have been a sinner. Perhaps the most damning note describes him as a tyrant in the parish. It's possible his absences did not cause too much parochial distress. He had an interesting background, being reputedly a direct descendant of Pocahontas, the Native American princess who married tobacco planter John Rolfe, but who died at the end of her visit to England and is buried at Gravesend. Even without such a romantic background, Elwin would have been quite an eccentric character in his own right. In Bhutan, having married his cousin Francis, he built a new rectory. More conventionally than the case with Bhutan Church, he commissioned an architect to design it. Internally, things were less conventionally arranged. Contemporary descriptions tell of the ground floor having unpainted and unpapered walls, windows without blinds, floors without carpets or any other covering, and a family appearing to occupy primarily the attics. Visitors wrote about dining off broken crockery. It must have been evident to them that neither he nor his wife were unduly worried about creature comforts. Here they brought up 5 children, of whom 2, both sons, survived into adulthood, each following his father into the church. When Elwin was away, he wrote frequently to his wife. His letters were lengthy, almost illegible, and predominantly described his conversations with various dinner companions. Thackeray was upset by some comments by Dickens and thought Dickens mad. General Sir William Napier had agreed with Elwin's views on the relative merits as military commanders of Marlborough and Hannibal, and thought both distinctly better than Wellington. Another conversation examined the skills as an orator of Peel and Pitt. There appear to have been few subjects on which Elwin did not have an opinion, and those opinions were widely canvassed. His publisher, John Murray, clearly welcomed them. Approached to publish Darwin's On the Origin of Species, Murray initially agreed, but then decided to think the matter over and forwarded the manuscript to Elwin for an opinion. Elwin commented at length and asked that his opinion be passed on to Darwin. Many clergy took considerable exception to the book when it was eventually published, challenging, as it did, the literal veracity of the Bible. Most prominent was Soapy Sam Wilberforce, Bishop of Oxford, whose scathing review of the work was published, ironically, in the Quarterly Review. Elwin was of a more liberal view, but still argued that the book should not be published. His concern was that some of Darwin's theories lacked sufficient evidential backing to be widely accepted as they stood, and he proposed that Murray should ask Darwin to write a book instead on the evolution of pigeons. Everybody, he asserted, is interested in pigeons. Murray duly passed the suggestion on to Darwin, who politely declined it, and Murray published the book. Elwin must have been a frustrating editor. He frequently left manuscripts unopened and unread for months. He rarely bothered to answer letters, even though Bhutan received its first postbox to accommodate his correspondence. Even the bishop complained that he never got a reply from him. He was so short-sighted that an acquaintance once described how Elwin wrote with his eye so close to the paper that it seemed to be resting on it. Once he explained his illegibility by writing that he was having to hold the writing paper in his hand because he could not disturb the parrot on his leg and the junior cat on his lap. He was certainly an unusual character, but a very gifted one. When he retired from his editorship, he continued to write, including a biography of Thackeray, which was unfinished at his death, but whose earlier chapters were published posthumously. He was a significant literary figure of his age, and it is that for which he is generally remembered. But in Norfolk, we can still enjoy his splendid exuberant folly, the church at Booton. Now in the safe hands of the church's Conservation Trust, it is well worth a visit. For a fuller account of the life of Whitwell Elwin, see Chris Armstrong's book Scholars, Saints and Sinners, Poppyland Publishing, 2019.